Hello and welcome to our very special Gascast Gapcast, where we'll be bringing you the best from the planet's biggest medical conference for anaesthetic trainees, the Group of Anaesthetists in Training Annual Scientific Meeting, otherwise known as the GATASM. I'm Rick Thomas, and with me is Mark Salmon.
Hello, GAP fans.
Seasoned professional conference podcast correspondent, June Rahman.
Hello.
And we're delighted to be joined by a new voice, Lucy Evans.
Hello.
So it's going to be a packed podcast with some great sound bites from some of the conference's speakers, organisers and delegates. But first, I caught up with now becoming friend of the podcast, William Harrop Griffith, who also happens to be President-elect of the AAGBI, and Samantha Shindy, the AAGBI Chair of Education. Thanks very much for inviting us to GAT and welcome to the GATcast.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
What makes the GAT ASM such a special meeting?
Well, it's actually the only international meeting for anaesthetic trainees. I think that's the most important thing. It's aimed for trainees. And actually, there's a lot of trainee input into designing the actual programme, so it's what they want. This year is the first year that the meeting, which has been run very successfully over the years, and Will and I have both attended meetings when we were younger, has been taken over by the Education Committee.
We've got the entire resources of the Association of Anaesthetists, and we are really focusing on GAT as one of our main meetings of the year. And I mean, credit to you, Sam, it's been fantastically successful. I mean, the number of registrants at this meeting is about twice as much as last year.
Yes, we've got...
And tell us about the posters.
Yes,
we're very excited about the posters.
So in terms of our numbers, we had 170 people last year, and it's over 350 this year. So it's more than double. It's been fantastic. Last year, we had about 100 posters, and this year, we've had over 230 high-quality posters. And we only have posters exhibited here of high quality, and it's judged by all members of the council and of Editorial Board of Anaesthesia. And it's been staggering, actually. And what's fascinating, really impressed me, is we've had a lot of foundation doctors, some medical students, and CT1, CT2 trainees producing posters of really high standards.
I saw yesterday a couple of FYs standing in front of a poster interacting with the senior editor of Anaesthesia, the journal. And it was brilliant interchange. It really is a great interface between the trainees and some very senior members. And what's more, we're handing out a lot of prizes.
Yep.
We're handing out a lot of commendations for posters.
Yes.
So not only are people getting the experience of coming to a great meeting, putting out their poster, talking to people about it, but there are lots of awards that they can then put into their CV and take forward into interviews in order to promote their career.
As you said, we've had an absolutely fantastic programme, some fascinating speakers and some really great clinically orientated lectures, which is perfect for trainees. Is there anything that you've heard in the last couple of days that you're going to be taking back to your practice?
Well, for me, it was alcohol is bad for you, and documentation is good for you.
Sam, you knew alcohol is bad for you right from the start.
So those are the two things that I'm going to take back.
I'm going to take back two talks. First of all, from the sheriff, who talked about her fatal accident inquiry into an airway problem. She talked through all the technical details. You could have heard a pin drop in this room of 300 people, when everybody was going through in their mind about what they would have done and why, frankly, the things that those anaesthetists did were actually quite reasonable. Mm-hmm. And the patient died. And then today, with Ellen O'Sullivan talking about the unanticipated difficult airway. For me, the big message that came along from both those talks is elective patient, airway problem, wake them up. Because the problem seemed to come is if you keep on trying to be determined to get a tube down and getting fixated in it. That got me very excited, got me very sweaty, got me very nervous, and got me even more committed to regional anaesthesia.
Twitter's been quite useful for this meeting. We like Twitter on Gascast. Nice to see you're on Twitter as well.
I've been tweeting. I'm a bit of a novice when it comes to tweeting, but I have actually been tweeting during the lectures, and I think I now have some followers. One of them is trying to sell me hair restorer. One thinks I may have erectile problems, but the other seven or eight are actually trainees in anaesthesia, and hopefully they're enjoying my tweets, and I will keep on tweeting until somebody tells me to stop.
And final question, you both were obviously trainees at some point. Any stories that you can broadcast from GAT meetings you went to?
No.
However, if you want to know more about Sam Shindy's early life at GAP meetings, all you have to do is email scandal@aagbi.org.
We can only speculate on what went on in GAT just a few years ago. But we've got a huge amount to pack in, so we'll crack straight on with our discoveries of the conference. Who would like to go first?
Mark.
Okay. I'm going to talk about one of the fantastic posters I saw in a wander around the extensive poster collection today. I think there's nearly 200 there. The one that caught my eye was an interesting little homemade experiment, which I always like. After the authors had a case in their hospital of a lost epidural catheter tip, they followed common advice, which was to do nothing about it, but the patient later returned complaining of back pain. And so in an attempt to find and deal with the catheter tip, they did plain x-rays and couldn't find it, despite the manufacturers claiming that their catheters were radio opaque. So these guys found seven or eight different manufactured catheters and put them into a large loin of pork. There's a picture on the poster. We'll put it on our website. I got a whole back of pig, basically, and put the epidural in it, and then took x-rays and discovered that, and some of them, they could just about see the catheter, but only really because they had an radio-opaque indicator, the level of the skin, to indicate where it was. So, basically, if you lose the tip, you're not going to be able to find it again. Whether they say it's radio-opaque
unless or not. You're looking in a loin of pork.
So question, how did they resolve the problem?
That wasn't commented on.
So they don't know if it was left in the patient or not?
Oh, they're pretty sure it was, but... Nobody can ever prove that. But I like that kind of...
Yeah.
I like
garden shed type experimentation.
Excellent. So, June, as you volunteered, Mark.
That's right. Well, following on from pork, my favourite discovery of the month, or the GAT, is the word formication, which means the sensation of ants crawling all over your skin. It's related to chronic pain or neuropathy or central sensitization, but I quite like gatti fornication.
Yeah, it's good. It's formication with an M.
Yes.
Just to make that clear.
Yes.
So you can quite legitimately say I've got formication in my pants when you can't sit still.
Right.
Just to make absolutely clear, they didn't learn this word because of the quality of the accommodation here.
Very, very true.
So, Lucy, what was the standout piece of information that you'll be telling everyone back at Southend?
Well, I don't know if you guys were in the talk, but apparently if you put a gum elastic bougie the wrong way round down a proceal LMA, that will get it to sit far more accurately over the larynx. That was actually quite a useful little tip.
Because I wasn't quite clear, how does that work? If you put that down, it comes out the esophageal port,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Mm.
And then does that force the esophageal port, presumably, to sit in the esophagus?
Yeah,
yes.
What they said was
so it's...
use a laryngoscope to watch the bougie into the esophagus, and then that's going to guide that port into the esophagus, which, as a surrogate, will position the opening over the larynx.
Great, so now when you're up to do, if you've got trouble seating your proceal. For my discovery, mine actually came from my man crush of the conference, Kenny Bailey. But this is a fantastic website. If, like me, you're not particularly good at physiology, find it a little bit complicated, there's too many variables happening at once, you need to check out www.prognosis.org, where there's a very, very clever clinical physiology simulator and ABG interpreter. It's based on some quite clever maths that I think Kenny did quite a few years ago. He's had some help turning into a Python script and presenting as a web page. But basically, it's a really nice presentation of an oxygen cascade with some AVGs. You put in the physiological parameters, so the respiratory, the blood, so HB, and sort of metabolic, what your oxygen consumption is. They're all down the left-hand side. You press calculate, then it shows you what happens to the oxygen cascade and the AVG. So what's really nice is you can simulate different clinical scenarios. So you can simulate an asthmatic patient, a bleeding obstetric patient. You can add altitude into the mix, so you can have an asthmatic bleeding obstetric patient who is on top of a mountain. It's absolutely brilliant. It's a fantastic visual learning tool or teaching resource, and it's very clever math that's been well presented. So we'll put a link on the notes to that, www.prognosis.org. This episode is doubly special as it's our 12th podcast and marks our 1 year anniversary. So thanks very much to everyone who's downloaded and listened, and especially to those who have emailed in and given us some feedback. Bex and Frank were both really disappointed they couldn't make it, but they did send me these.
Hi, it's me. Greetings from California. Sorry I couldn't be at GAC. It sounds absolutely fantastic. I'm looking forward to hearing a bit more about it on this episode of GACcast. Unfortunately, I've been having a holiday in California, eating a lot of snacks that say in big, bold writing, this is not a low-calorie snack. So I've been otherwise occupied. Anyway, looking forward to a bit of light entertainment, and I will be back with you guys next month. So, chat to you again from Canada.
Hi, guys. I'm really sorry I couldn't join Mark and Rick for the GAT ASM in Glasgow. By now, June has become a regular stand-in, and thanks to her and Lucy for covering for Bex and myself. He couldn't join you on this occasion. Incredibly, I was asked to speak at a national AAGBI conference to some perioperative nurses, and that clashed with the Thursday date of the GAT meeting, and I couldn't make it up to share in the fun and some of the interviews of some what looked like fantastic talks. I've really enjoyed doing the podcasting over this last year, and I know we're all looking forward to carrying on and trying to provide episodes that you're all enjoying. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you next month.
Thanks very much for sending those in, guys. It's been great fun to do the podcast for last year, and we hope that we'll be celebrating our 2 year anniversary this time next year. Being the GAT conference, June and I caught up with some of the GAT committee members to find out a little more about what GAT is about, why you should join, and the conference here in Glasgow.
We've now come to the end of the first day of a very interesting and smoothly run GAT annual scientific meeting, also known as GATASM, I believe. But before we head off to Wexford Commons for a pint, I'm going to spend a few minutes talking to Richard Poole, Honorary Secretary of GAT, Mike McMahon, who's coming to the end of his 3 year term as an elected member of the AGBI involved in education, and Nick Love, Chair of GAT. Thank you for organising an excellent meeting in Glasgow. What have been most challenging parts of organising this meeting?
I think that's a question for Mike, really.
Well, putting the programme together has actually not been difficult. There's a great deal of enthusiasm amongst the consultants for educating us, and pretty much everyone I've asked has been delighted to take the opportunity. And what goes along with that is the AAGBI events team could not have been more helpful to have sorted out the logistics. Touch wood, I've not found anything that's been difficult so far.
And what are you most looking forward to?
The Pinkerton lecture, which has just been, was we'd been stuck for a speaker and someone had suggested that we got a sheriff. And
it sounds exciting before you start that you're going to get a sheriff coming up and talking.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd not anticipated just how powerful a talk she was going to give. It really kind of blew everyone away.
Excellent. So you must have been to a fair few of these meetings over the years.
This is my fourth GAT conference. I think we've got a good venue. We've got a very keen local group. A lot of Scottish trainees have come along, so we've got a lot of local people involved. By matching the content to the curriculum has made some lectures more focused than previously. They've been very generic, non-specific, interesting lectures, but this now it's more honed to the curriculum.
So what would you tell a young anaesthetic trainee just starting out why they should join GAT?
Well, from the education point of view, every new member of the AGBI will be given one free meeting or seminar. So that is something that I don't think should be sniffed at.
I never had that.
No.
It's only started in the last 18 months, I think.
We can't retrospectively claim it.
Any other last
I think tips? One of the main reasons why I joined is the insurance for doing inter-hospital transfers. You're not covered by your hospital. It's a very cheap policy. It's included free in your membership. If you, my own insurance company, were mentioning about it, and they were quoting me thousands of pounds when I said I could get it for the price, they just went, yeah, take that.
I think one of the other things you could say is that it's value for money. Where else can you get to go to a conference that spans 3 days? It's £195. It gives you advanced workshops in ventilation, ultrasound, You can't. It's very expensive.
Can I cut in with one final point as to why you should join up with GAT? We are the only independent representative body for trainee anaesthetists. The college committee, while they are doing a great job in their infancy, they have to report to the council of the Royal College and are thus a little tied and restricted in what the opinions they can voice, whereas we are truly independent and we're out there to look after your interests.
Within the AGBI, we are very attuned and very keen to hear trainees' views and opinions, so all committees and all working parties have at least one trainee representation on it. They are paying attention to trainees' views, and I think that should be encouraged.
I agree with that. Nick, Richard and Mike, thank you very much. And first pint's on me.
Oh, great.
You got that on recording.
For those of you who weren't able to get to the conference, we really enjoyed some of the excellent lectures here. And Mark, I was sitting next to you while you were scribbling furiously during Professor Sneed's lecture, and you obviously didn't need a depth of anaesthesia monitor.
Well, I certainly did have a bit of 100 during that lecture, but then again, so do many brain-dead ITU patients in some studies. Professor Sneed, as many of you know, is the Dean at Peninsula College of Medicine and Dentistry in Plymouth. He's also Vice President of the Royal College of Anaesthetists and a Director with the European Society of Anaesthesiology. Mainly I was interested in his talk about depths of anaesthesia because I was a new SHO when BIS monitors kind of hit the mainstream hospitals and were popular for a while, but I haven't really seen or heard much about them in the last few years, so I was keen to find out what I'd missed and what is going on. So Professor Sneed started by explaining the degree of the problem, and that is that awareness in general anaesthesia occurs in about 0.13% of adults, up to 1% in higher risk cases. There are now several different machines on the market, all competing to give us the magic number from 0 to 100, using various ways of processing and analysing EEGs. And so, in summary really, despite the manufacturer's best efforts, several studies comparing depth of anaesthesia monitors with using a tight regime for prescribing the end-tidal concentrations of anaesthetic agents and then setting up monitors to make sure you stay within those targets haven't really demonstrated any difference. And in fact, some studies suggest that just keeping a good eye with monitors on your end-tidal concentrations might even be more effective at preventing awareness. So following that, the research moved on a bit. The manufacturers wanted, I think, to show that overdosing people with anaesthetic agents was harmful and produced some studies analysing large numbers retrospectively of cases and suggesting that people whose BIS levels fell below 45 had a greater mortality in the long run. The long and short of it is that the recent NICE recommendations on BIS are that probably does reduce your usage and cost of volatile anaesthetic agents, but there's not really enough evidence to suggest that it's reducing the incidence of awareness.
It was a really interesting talk, actually. I thought, for all those reasons you said, Mark, and I'm much the same as you. I remember them coming in as an SHO, but lots of the older anaesthetists saying the way to stop awareness is to give an anaesthetic. Mm. I certainly remember a trend, especially when the BIS monitors came, actually, about people trying to use less and less and giving dangerously small amounts.
I think that's the danger, isn't it? Because I've certainly worked with people who think, well, that's the number, it's fine to have them on a MAC of 0.6. And, well, I think Prof. Sneed had a very good point in saying that, actually, are we going to increase the risk of awareness because we're dangerously dropping the amount of anaesthetic agent that we give to a patient.
Mm. So we're at risk of under-anaesthetising patients, and that was his,
I think that was his
big message at the end of the day, although I thought it was quite interesting. The reason why people are using BIS more and more, and particularly in America, is because it is a defensive way of anaesthetising a patient. And therefore, if a patient says, I was awake during that time in court, you can say, well, the BIS machine says you weren't awake.
The magic black box declared that you were asleep.
That's right.
Which I think is intuitive, especially to lay people, that they kind of assume that we have a box with a number from 0 to 100 that tells us what's going on. It's what you'd imagine.
Well, yeah. I think most lay people think for ages we've had some special machine that tells us that the patients are asleep, and when you tell them that actually no, that's not the case, they're absolutely horrified.
And as Professor Steed said, I think a lot of people still think anaesthesia or consciousness is a binary on or off function and not the continuum that we are kind of used to.
The part of that lecture I liked most, the part that woke me up the most, was his description of how they gave somebody succinylcholine, and the BIS machine showed they had a BIS of about 30 to 50, so they were fully awake. And then the other one was where the BIS had mistaken the ECG for the EEG.
My crass joke about the brain dead patients at the start. I mean, it wasn't 100, but they were up to 50.
That was excellent. Who would volunteer for a study where they give you some sucks and no anaesthetic?
Someone not in their right mind, I think.
You probably already brain dead. Baseline BIS of 85.
Excellent. So, for our next interview, I caught up with a future medical research star, who I've already mentioned, Kenny Bailey, who delivered the prestigious Wiley Lecture. He's a really impressive guy and a trainee who's already done some incredibly impressive research. And here is what he had to say to me.
It's my absolute pleasure to be talking to Kenny Bailey. Kenny is a clinical lecturer in critical care medicine at the University of Edinburgh and an immensely successful clinical researcher. Kenny, welcome to Gascast.
Thanks very much indeed.
So if I could start by asking you, what is the best thing about a career in research?
I think probably the single best thing about it is that I can have an idea right then that morning and then go straight into work and start testing it. So I have complete freedom to follow whatever ideas come to me. The ability to just follow your dreams anywhere you like is an extraordinary privilege of academic life.
You covered this in your lecture, but you've gone from swabbing anaesthetic machines to being first name author on a publication in Nature about retrotransposons in what's really a phenomenally short space of time. What advice have you got for junior trainees who are interested in getting into research?
Well, certainly I've been very lucky to work with some extremely talented people at the Roslin Institute in Edinburgh. I think probably the best decision I made was on the academic training scheme that I'm on, which is called the ECAT scheme, Edinburgh Clinical Academic Track. There are versions of it in most universities. I was actively encouraged by John Iredale and Brian Walker, the two professors who run it, to go and do something different. So rather than follow the track I was on, which was largely sort of clinical physiological research that was very much home turf for an anaesthetic trainee, to go and learn something new, and for me that was genomics, in which I could then offer a world of added value by speaking both languages, both the basic science of what for me has ended up being really computational genomics, and understanding where those tools can be applied in clinical practice.
Your recent paper in Nature was looking at the genetic susceptibility to the flu pandemic of 2009. Are we going to be hearing more about that work?
I certainly hope so. We had an early success that was led by Paul Kellum at the Sanger Institute, who identified IFIT-M3 as a gene that causes susceptibility to flu in mice, and in our clinical samples from London and Liverpool in a study called Mosaic and from Scotland in a study called Genesis, we found that there was an association with susceptibility to severe disease in humans. The total number of samples we actually used for that was 60. In order to really do genetic research properly, if you look across the entire genome rather than at just one gene, you need thousands of patients, and we're now trying very hard to find them. So we've identified that the people we're really interested in are the people that were extremely susceptible. 80% of people who got flu during the pandemic didn't even notice they got it, but about 1 in 10,000 ended up in critical care. And these are previously healthy people that I'm talking about. Fortunately, the vast majority of them survived. We know that they'll have returned to the baseline mortality for young healthy people, so they're still around, and we can go and get them. We have their names and addresses in various audit databases, or we can extract them if we get the relevant approvals and go and look. So we're applying for funding now to establish a global study to try and track these people down and do a really properly powered genome-wide study of susceptibility to flu. And that's something I'm very excited about.
No, that's fantastic. Thanks very much for talking to us, and hopefully we can catch up with you again on a later podcast. And Kenny's a Twitter follower, and you can follow him at Kenneth Bailey. Thank Super, you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So June, with your interest in law and ethics, I noticed your ears prick up during the Pinkerton lecture, which was given by Sheriff Linda Ruxton.
Well, this lecture, the Pinkerton lecture, was definitely the highlight of the whole GAT meeting, and I think most people will agree, but luckily I get to talk about it. And Sheriff Linda Ruxton was a very eloquent and fascinating speaker. But she was involved in the fatal accident inquiry concerning the case of Gordon Ewing. I don't know if many people have heard about this case. So Gordon Ewing was a youngish man who was scheduled for an elective operation on his little finger. He was generally fit and well, however he did have a high BMI, hiatus hernia and esophageal reflux. So the anaesthetist in question went to see him, did all the appropriate preoperative assessments, had made her anaesthetic plan, had a plan A and a plan B. She decided she was going to carry out a rapid sequence induction. When he came into the anaesthetic room, she put in a cannula, put on the monitoring, had explained to the patient that what she was going to do. And I must mention at this stage that patient had requested a general anaesthetic as opposed to a local block. So she gave 500 of thiopentone, followed by 100 milligrams of succinylcholine. When she put the laryngoscope down, all she could see was tongue, a little bit of epiglottis, and that was it. Now, pre-op, his assessment was a Malampati 1, he had good neck movement, and nothing to say that he would be a difficult intubation. And he'd had an anaesthetic recently, general anaesthetic recently, which was straightforward. So she had a situation where he can't intubate, but could ventilate. At this point, she called for help. Another anaesthetist and a very senior and experienced trainee arrived, and they had decided they were going to then try and intubate the patient through an intubating LMA. This is the stage where everything started to go wrong. There is a very good report of it on the internet if anybody's interested in the details, but to cut a long story short, they then passed a Cook catheter. Suddenly the patient started to blow up. His face went red, his chest expanded, his abdomen expanded. What had happened was that nobody was experienced in using the Cook catheter, and it had ended up in the right chest wall. So this patient who'd come in for a straightforward procedure had arrested and then died, and the verdict was death due to barotrauma.
One of the good learning points from this was to wake the patient up. And actually, going back to a podcast we did a couple of months ago about anaesthetic non-technical skills, this is also a case of task fixation, which I think was probably made worse by safety in numbers. Mm. And I think this came up with some feedback from the one anaesthetic trainee who was in the room, who said, I would have spoken up had it not been for the fact there were two or three consultants there. And once you have that many people around, then it's probably in some ways easier to get task fixated, to share the responsibility and not to bail out. So waking the patient up is an option. One of the other things that really came out was, and this was came out in another lecture, but this was a good example and you touched on it, was that quite often you start being able to oxygenate and ventilate these patients. Again, I've been a trainee during a developing airway circus. It's the ventilation in between attempts that becomes progressively more difficult. And then as soon as you can't ventilate, you can't oxygenate. And that's when you start to go towards your hypoxic arrest or cricothyroidotomy. Thanks very much, James. Fantastic case, as you said. Picture incredibly well painted by Sheriff Linda Ruxton. My only disappointment was that she did not have a badge, gun and spurs. Regular listeners will have heard me bang on about my favourite educational Twitter resource, Gas Class, and I met up with one of the linchpins behind this project, Jeff Duran, during one of the poster sessions.
So I'm at the massive poster section. We've heard Sam Shindy and William Harrop
Griffiths talk about, and I had the pleasure of speaking to Jeff Durant, who is one of the people behind Gas Glass, the thing I go on and on about that I absolutely love, and I hope some more people are having a look at. So Jeff, tell us, how did you come up with the idea for Gas Glass?
So there's a small team of us behind it. One of which is a consultant with an interest in medical education. I came at it really from just a general interest in technology, and I was using Twitter as an information tool really anyway, just kind of coming up from work and put our heads together and thought there's probably something in this with regard to delivering education in a new way. It started off just as a trial really. We thought we'd put a date out there, we'd try and get a case-based discussion going and see what happened, and then it formulated from there into a term's worth of cases. We did 10 cases, had a bit of a gap, did another 10 and had a bit of a gap, and we've tried to sort of bring a little more expansion into it every term. We've tried to do something a bit new just to keep the interest up really.
The cases are really excellent, and I love the way they seem to mirror the whole curriculum actually. You've got ophthalmic anesthesia 1 week, then you've got some pain, yeah. I think it's cardiothoracics this week, isn't it? It's absolutely fantastic. Who comes up with the cases?
They're all theoretical cases. We make sure that none of them are genuine real life cases because it's all in the public domain, obviously. Most of which we have a brief discussion between the three of us, one of which will take on the case for that particular week. Often it's a case that somebody's got an interest in, which gives us a bit of more expert knowledge, really. We try and think of subjects that are appropriate to training. So we knew that we had to do some blood transfusion training in our department at work. We came up with a case that was there was a transfusion reaction involving a polytrauma case. So we sort of really tried to pad the case out and get as many sort of aspects of, you know, clinical details and clinical scenarios into that case. And what we tried to do within the second term was actually transfer some of that online, the online classroom, if you like, into a face-to-face classroom as well. So by having a Thursday lunchtime meeting in our own department, we had the online discussion beforehand about transfusion, and then on that Thursday we had some sort of transfusion training as well, really, to try and round it out.
Which is one of the things I really like about Gas Glass. It's a fantastic multimodal online tool. Yeah. You've got the discussion going on Twitter,
yeah.
You've got the WordPress site with the case information, yeah, that gets updated, and then of course you've got the comments section on the WordPress site,
yeah,
which reflects your meeting in greater depth.
Yeah.
And it's just, I just think it's a fantastic way. Like all the things, educational tools that are out there at the moment, getting little snippets here and there, week by week, keeping your general anaesthesia knowledge up to scratch, and especially for something like anaesthetic, which has such a broad knowledge base to cover. It's really nice every week to see something new and something a bit different.
I think one of the a lot of our trainees were kind of fairly new to Twitter, and a lot of them are still quite reluctant, I think, to take it on. But the feedback we had from the trainees that started using it were they were really finding it as quite a powerful information tool, and quite quickly they were able to develop a sort of an information network where they were getting information and tweets from the Royal College, from the AAGBI, from people attending various meetings. And I think it's a really, really powerful tool that we should, you know, as technology is so good now. I mean, the power of the smartphone has really, really, really brought information and technology together. I think we will see more and more uses of Twitter as an information feed in the future, really.
One of the other nice things that we found with Gascast, I know you've got from here, is to get the international contributions.
Yeah.
Because the internet has no geographical barriers, it's really interesting to hear the perspective from other countries that people have on the cases that you put forward, particularly for the way they do things differently in Australasia.
Yeah, absolutely. I think looking at the hits on our WordPress site, we actually get an idea of the geography where people are coming from. It pans out quite nicely in that you can see it's mostly coming from the west, but we'd get a lot of visitors, particularly getting places from India and in Asia and things like that as well now. And it's nice just to see, like you say, to make that comparison of how people are doing stuff internationally. And I think it just rounds out the educational experience in that if you just train just in one place, for instance, if you've trained in one hospital, you get a very one-directional view of how things are done. And really, as clinicians, we should be open-minded about things being done in different ways and just fill out that experience, really.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Jeff. It's an absolutely fantastic idea and excellently done. And I'm, as I said before, a massive fan.
Thanks very much.
So Lucy, you've worked at Great Ormond Street and have an interest in paediatrics. You were presumably very interested in the paediatric session.
I thought you saw me taking lots of notes, actually.
I did.
So if you're a budding enthusiast for paediatrics, then this would have been a nice talk to go to. But I think even if you weren't, there are some good take-home messages. With regards to the airway side of things, she gave a nice little talk about causes of airway obstruction. If you remember your nice surgical sieves from medical school, a lot of people like to think about congenital problems in paediatrics, but never forget the acquired, and that's probably what you're more likely to see in the DGH environment.
So Lego brick is probably the one you should be thinking about.
Or happy birthday words, which is my experience of a one-year-old swallowed the writing on their birthday cake.
Fantastic.
They literally swallowed their own words.
They had, literally.
Just quickly, what are the congenital causes, just for those people doing MCQs?
Okay, so she nicely subdivided them into dynamic causes and physically obstructive causes. So for those of you that really aren't familiar with those sorts of concepts, the dynamic causes are laryngomalacia and tracheomalacia. And then the sort of congenital obstructive causes are conditions like subglottic stenosis and laryngeal webs. I think the take-home messages from the airway side of things, though, were that the APA-GBI, so the Association of Paediatric Anaesthetists, have just come up with a very definitive set of airway guidelines for managing difficult bag mask ventilation, the unanticipated difficult airway, or difficult intubation, shall I say, and the can't intubate, can't ventilate situation, which are slightly different to the guidelines for adults. And it's worth having a look on the APA website, because they're really straightforward, they're really nicely represented guidelines that are quite easy to read.
So when you're faced with the complex congenital heart patient who's coming in for an emergency, what was the take-home advice there?
I think the take-home advice was certainly that it depends on the institution that you're working in. If you're working in a DGH, then there are certainly things you can do to help the patient, but you need to be getting on the phone and speaking to the tertiary centre. You need to be involving the local paediatricians. But there are things you can do, like getting IV access or IO access. And if it's certainly a very sick neonate, which that's everyone's nightmare situation, isn't it, that you get a paediatric call down to A&E resus to a sick 2 or 3 day old baby. Is it sepsis or is this a clapped out cardiac baby that's about to arrest? And that can be very difficult to distinguish. And it's something that very, very few trainee anaesthetists, and certainly myself included, will have very limited experience of. But the key take-home message is that if there's any doubt, then there is less harm in starting Prostin, which, for those of you who will rue the day you did not learn your fetal cardiology or your fetal circulation.
Prostin closes all the gaps.
No, it opens.
Oh,
it opens.
Oh, you see, I didn't learn that.
Look at her ruining in the corner right now.
God, I'm not dealing with DNA.
But for those of you that suddenly discover that actually knowing your fetal circulation was actually, or learning your fetal circulation was probably a good idea, you will appreciate the fact that Prostin holds that ductus arterius open. So that if you've got that very, very sick baby who isn't responding to normal management, if they've been treated like a septic baby, that giving them Prostin will hold that duct open and potentially save their life. So that's just something to think about.
So, Mark, I know Bex will be very, very jealous because you talked to probably her role model, Ireland's First Lady of Anaesthesia.
And mine too.
Oh, and June's as well.
Yes, I did, Rick. I had a lovely chat with the always impeccably turned out Dr. O'Sullivan. We're here now with Ellen O'Sullivan, who is the Vice President of the AAGBI and also President of DAS and newly elected President of the College of Anaesthetists of Ireland. Hello.
Hello.
So we've had lots of interesting talks and events so far at this GAT conference. What's caught your eye?
Well, I was fascinated by Sheriff Roxton's presentation, and this was all centred on the fatal accident inquiry on the case of Gordon Ewing, the sad airway death, which happened in Glasgow, and it was all about improving patient safety and lessons learned. And coming with my background from the Difficult Airway Society, I sort of we use this case often as a teaching case, sad though it is, because there are lots of lessons learned, and a lot of these are rather highlighted in the NAP4 audit. And although fatal accident inquiries are very useful in getting data, it's only when we have something like NAP4, which has not been done anywhere else in the world, where we have denominator, numerator, we had a snapshot, so we know how many anaesthetics were given, so we can put into context the problems, and then every case is analysed, so lessons could be learned from it, and lessons keep repeating. The lessons, for instance, of managing the unanticipated difficult intubation, having a plan, having a strategy. And although everybody's familiar with the difficult airway algorithms, they don't have it ready in their minds when they approach cases, as was seen in the Gordon Ewing case. And when things got wrong, and when they were using the ILMA, using equipment they weren't very maybe familiar with, things went wrong and they didn't bail out when they should have done, and perhaps prevented this awful tragedy. So it's learning from these disasters, but also putting into practice. And NAP4 was published in 2011, and before that we had lots of papers from the closed claim studies in the States, which brought up similar points right back from the 1990s, but we never learned the lessons. So I think in time now we have to start learning the lessons. And for that reason, although NAP4 is a nice book out there and two papers in the BGA and editorial anaesthesia, we do need, though, to progress it. So we're hoping, we've met the college recently, and NAP and DAS and the Royal College are now going to approve appointment of airway leads in departments. So these are people in the departments that will look after the equipment, look after the algorithms, make sure there's local training, etc., and do the questionnaire follow-ups as well on the implications of NAP and the recommendations of NAP and how they were brought forward. So that will be happening fairly soon. And we would hope that these airway leads will be the enthusiasts, and with the trainees in the department, they'll set up a series of teaching. So all the trainees are taught the various other guidelines, and also taught the skills that they need to manage these, unfortunately, these cases when they happen.
Well, that sounds great. I look forward to getting involved in my own region, because these things, as you say, are rare, but when they happen, they can be terrifying. And I think the more drilled we are and the more familiar we are with the algorithms and the techniques, the more likely we'll be able to keep a level head and resolve these situations. All right, so moving on, you were recently elected, as I said, as president of the College of Anaesthetists of Ireland. Mm-hmm. So what's happening in the Republic at the moment, and what are your big challenges?
Well, it's a very exciting time to be joining the college as president, because there have been a lot of changes. And I suppose one significant change that is happening in Ireland is in our training. And from July of this year, in fact, next month, we're introducing a six-year training programme from the seven-year that we've always had traditionally, very like the one in the UK, with after you finish your BST, with a competitive interview to your SPR level. But we've looked at the numbers, and now we're looking at training people from beginning to end, and hopefully this will try to match the numbers of posts available at the end. So it's a run-through training with, and once you get your competencies at BST level, the old after 2 years, then you can continue on and score your SATs, it's called, change to specialist anaesthesia training. And when you come out after 6 years, you'll hopefully have completed all your modules and all your training. And in your last year, if you've completed all the modules, you will have some opportunity to do some special interest work as well. And another significant change, I suppose, well, it links in a little bit with training and exams, is that when you've got your primary, you will then get a membership.
Right.
Your primary will be equivalent to a membership in anaesthesia as well. That's been introduced. And it's hoped that the final exam might be taken a little bit later. That hasn't quite been worked out. Not an exit exam, but maybe in your fourth, fifth year. And also the assessments of competencies throughout your training.
Okay. So a lot of critics at the moment say that with European working time legislation and on-call commitments, trainees are getting less supervision. So people may suggest that shortening your training programme would exacerbate that.
This is something we've quoted from the UK because of European Working Time Directive. We haven't gone down the route of the shortened working week for trainees. They still work quite long hours, so I think super, and they're usually with consultants at Inlis, so we haven't that issue. So this is one of the reasons I think we were shortening the training, because I think people right. felt they were overtrained. Also in Ireland, I suppose, because it's very peridimal and consultant, there are less consultant posts than there are here. All the trainees tend to go away before they, almost all the trainees leave the country to do further training and fellowships abroad before they come back for consultant posts.
I see.
So they do tend to get further training anyway abroad in specific areas. That has been the trend before they come back to consultant posts in Ireland.
Well, I'm just going to add, I was just chatting to one of the trainee reps from the College of Australia at Anaesthetics,
yes.
and he was saying that they are increasing the number of medical schools and there will be more doctors in the future, but the outposts, so
yes.
Western Northern Australia, still really very short of anaesthetists and all specialties.
That's right, and they advertise
yeah.
quite a lot, and I
they
think
do.
There's quite
yeah.
nice financial incentives to work in these places, and
absolutely.
Similarly in rural Canada
yeah.
as well.
Dr. O'Sullivan, thank you very much for talking to us, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So it wouldn't be an episode of Gascast unless we ended with my favourite game, Biology of Buncombe. And for this episode, I'm going to be keeping it local and historical with some famous Scottish medical scientists. I'm going to remind you of their discoveries and what's made them famous. But also, I've gone a little bit into their personal interests. And you have to tell me which one of their hobbies is made up. So, first up, we have Scottish physician and chemist Joseph Black, 1728-1799. He spent a lot of time watching ice melt and water boil and causing headaches for primary FRCA candidates because he discovered latent and specific heat and carbon dioxide. But was he the inventor of the ice sculpture? Our second contestant will be familiar to everybody. Alexander Fleming, 1881 to 1955, Nobel Prize winner. Scottish biologist and pharmacist who discovered penicillin, but in his spare time, did he enjoy glassblowing? And finally, we have James Young Simpson, who was a Scottish obstetrician from 1811 to 1870, and the discoverer of the anaesthetic properties of chloroform. He had a wide range of intellectual interests, but was one of them hermaphroditism. So, June, which one of those is the buncombe?
Well, I have to say, okay, so ice sculpture, I thought that was a recent invention. Glass blowing is relatively old, and I think hermaphroditism is also quite recently known about. Knowing you, you try to double bluff. So I'm going to go for something that's not obvious, or maybe is obvious, actually.
You've double bluffed me now.
Ice sculpture.
Ice sculpture.
Joseph Black.
Okay. So Joseph Black and your ice sculpture. Lucy, it's your first go at this. Give it your best shot.
I'm going to go with, I don't think Alexander Fleming did glass blowing. And my reasoning is very, very basic. In that Joseph Black from Scotland, ice sculpture, well, it's cold, maybe. And James Simpson, who had something to do with obstetrics, hermaphroditism, possible. So I'm going to go with glass blowing and Alexander Fleming.
And he was too busy watching mould anyway.
That's very true.
He was very busy watching mould. Mark, seasoned expert.
Yeah, so I've made my decision. So, glassblowing, I think, probably could be true. Lots of old-school scientists used to make their own equipment, flasks and so on. Hermaphroditism, who in the world isn't interested in that? Answers on a postcard, write and let us know if you're not, and then I'll write back to you and say, I don't believe you. So that leaves ice sculpture. I think that is the buncombe.
Okay, so everybody thought that hermaphroditism was true. Completely true, James Young Simpson was interested in hermaphroditism. As Mark said, nothing to be ashamed of. Lucy, it's your first go at this, and you thought Alexander Fleming and glass blowing. I'm sorry to say, that is completely true.
Oh!
Not only was he
beginner's luck again!
That's very much beginner's luck.
No, he's saying you lost.
I'm saying you lost.
Oh, did you?
Oh!
Yeah.
Oh, that is completely... Oh, yes.
Yeah.
You have no beginning glitch, and you're awful at this game, and you won't be invited to play again.
Seriously?
Probably for the reasons Mark said. I think they did used to make their own equipment.
Fair enough.
So, I'm sorry about that. June and Mark, very well done.
Yes.
I thought I was being quite clever, because I thought if he was, you know, he discovered specific and latent heat and carbon dioxide, he might well have been spending a lot of time with ice. But Joseph Black was not at all into ice sculpting. He was into poker, but not ice sculpting. So congratulations, that was this month's Bunkum. We've had a fantastic time here in Glasgow, and it's been another great conference. We're certainly booking our study leave well ahead of time for next year's event in Oxford. Thanks very much to the AAGBI and GAT for inviting us. Big thank you to Lucy and June, and Mark and I will be back with Frank and Bex next month. Thanks very much for listening.